right, Mr. Patterson, could you state your full name?
Alfred Patterson.
And we are at?
County Corp's headquarters, our office building at 130 West 2nd Street, Dayton, Ohio.
Great, and it's August 20th. So
it is indeed.
All right, so we were just speaking and I interrupted, so I apologize.
Go back as far as you can in looking at the history of Dayton. I believe that you will find that what is part of the problem, if it can be described as a problem, I think is one. West Dayton was divided into two predominant areas, if you will. One was the Jewish community, which seemingly or perceptually was more affluent, and then the other was the Black community. And then on the other side of the river was predominantly the white community, with the affluent being focused in the Oakwood, Kettering area. But what kind of took place was, as the Jewish community decided to leave that traditional area that they pretty much established, which is what we call Upper Dayton View, actually even so far down as Southern Dayton View. If you go through, and you can look out my window, and if you look west, you can't see up Salem, but if you can see up Salem Avenue, as you cross that bridge that you can see with the orange cones on it, not the one that's going north and south, but that west bridge that you can see that's leading into those apartments, what looks like old-style apartment buildings, okay, that's Salem Avenue as you go up. And that area, just west of those buildings that you see, all that area back there is lower than you. And as you travel up Salem further, I guess you can't, I don't know if you can pick us up or not.
Right.
As you travel up Salem Avenue, you get into Upper Dayton View, or what's called the Golden Triangle. Okay. Now, the dilemma with Dayton, from what I understand in talking to folks that collected this kind of data and were around when some of these things developed, is that the affluent white population, and we're talking people like John H. Patterson, the Kettering family, all of those folks had kind of an enclave. And so naturally, those people that wanted to emulate them got as close to them as they possibly could. So you had an area just east of the river that was predominantly white. But it was not necessarily affluent. So you had a lot of folks who were very poor. You had a lot of uneducated, illiterate people who had to take menial tasks, but they were white. And so that developed a true animosity, because once you crossed the bridge, then you had the predominant Black population, but you also had most of the Jewish population also. The Jewish population having some degree of wealth and resource, used the Black population pretty much as the workers. So you had a Black population that was able to work, but you had a white population that wasn't as able to work. And while you had most of the companies here at that time that only hired white folk, they wanted educated, trained white folk, which there were not a lot of, right? Because the white population during that time was mostly illiterate. In fact, at one point they were more illiterate than the Black population. So you had Black folks on the west side that were able to work, weren't getting rich, but they were able to work consistently. Plus they were learning the skills that support community, all right? Everything that was getting done, they were the ones that were doing it. So they understood a lot of the, and we're talking late 18th century, so you didn't have, you didn't have a lot of, in early 19th century, so you didn't have a lot of technology. Everything was agriculture and manual labor, you know, that sort of, you know. So you had a growing animosity. which is human nature, so to speak. You know, this, we all look across the field and see what those folks have that we don't have, and we become desirous, we become envious of that. In a society where you can actually take it, then that's generally what you do. You know, if it were society of equals, then you'd look across the road and you say, well, I wish I had that. And you figure out a way to build your own. But in America, because of the racial structure that we have, then you figure out ways to cross over and you just simply go take it or you destroy it or whatever. If you can't have it, if I can't have it, you won't either. So we had a situation where there was a certain amount of animosity that grew out of the fact that the perception was that the black folks on the west side of town were doing better than the white folks on the east side of town. So as we grew away from agriculture and more intensive labor-oriented type jobs, and we got into becoming a modern city, if you will, then of course it became the white folks that were better educated, that had more opportunity. And so until the industrial age, when General Motors and that sort of stuff started to come in and hiring just about everybody, then you had a large disparity, and it was economic. But it allowed the what we now perceive as the segregation of the communities, that was how it developed, because now you had an opportunity for white folks to have more. Unfortunately, if you look at Upper Dayton View and even Southern Dayton View, those were the better homes. They were larger, the boulevards were wider. Because it was closer to downtown, and see, in the beginning, downtown is the hub. You had the affluent people that were, let's say, middle class. They went west. The truly affluent people separated themselves by the river, but in that small enclave we call Oakwood, so to speak. The poorer white folks, wanting to emulate those with money, went across the river, but they had to kind of circle around them, so to speak, and so you had a poorer east side. So, but these homes, if you look at the, if you go into Kettering, you'll see that the homes closer to Oakwood are impressive. But as you just, you know, as you just move out through Kettering, you've got 12, 13, 1400 square foot frame houses that were built after the war. Not necessarily impressive. However, you had a larger community at that time on this side of homes that were nice two-story homes, three bedrooms, one and a half bath, homes that were truly more desirable. So, as money and income increased, those white folks on the east side, a lot of them decided that, you know what, I'd rather live over there. So you had a growing, then you started to have the isolation of black folk. And then it was, that's when the redlining, and this is pre-redlining. This is when it was just real simple. We lived west of 3rd Street. We lived 5th Street. We lived in an area, as you look across the highway, we lived over there. And that became, over time, a very depressed area. Our numbers grew, and we started to move up into what's now called Westwood, which was a nice place to live. But at that time, then a structure developed that put the resources of Montgomery County into the areas that were white. And so you started to see deterioration and declining of the things that cities provide. You know, you started to see that, which of course had an effect. So ultimately, the process has been one, as generally all processes are, where the human, and see, I don't believe, now, you know, look, I'm 60 years old, I'm 59 years old, and I'm black. So racism is no, it's not foreign to me. But at the same time, I've seen much worse. I was in a service down south, I've lived down south, I've lived other places. And for a Midwestern city that is as rural as Ohio is, I know we don't think of Ohio as rural, but Ohio is really a very, very rural state. Yeah. It's not as bad as it could be, right? But at the same time, what happened was a very institutionalized process took root that basically says, okay, I see where you live, that's fine, but we're not gonna put resources where you live. We're gonna put resources every place else, but we're not gonna put resources where you live. Therefore, we started into a process of decline. And then when you have situations where, you know, obviously, in the beginning, in the late 1800s, you couldn't buy a house because you weren't allowed to. You know, the law says you can own property. However, the practice was that you can't own property. And then if you look through Dayton's history, there was a big deal where folks would come up with money to buy property. But because the recorder's office would not record a title in a black person's name, you had to have a white person basically own your house that was decent enough person to realize that you really owned it, but since property could not be recorded in your name, or would not be recorded, the law says it could, but by practice it would not be recorded in your name, then you couldn't own the property. So it became a process of rentals. We were all rental properties. Now, as you looked, but that was difficult because we came from a place where we owned land. And now you can't own it anymore, you can only rent. Which set to destabilize the familial structure. You know, when you own a thing, it's very easy to teach you pride and ownership and self-respect when you own something. Because you own something that has value, and that value is respected throughout society. You own property. However, when you're not allowed to own property, then it's kind of a waterfall effect. The family structure is not as stable. The ability for self-esteem, self-empowerment, those things are not as stable because you don't have that foundation that equates your value with the common or the majority value. So it was through this process that a lot of ills were perpetrated, but ultimately it was just a function of, you know, isolating. Okay, this is where you live and you're gonna stay there. You can't move anyplace else, you can't buy property anyplace else, and this is where you're gonna be. And then if we don't provide services, then obviously this area is gonna deteriorate a lot. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes people can prove themselves self-sufficient. You know, necessity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. So we figured things out. And then as we got into the 30s and 40s, General Motors, NCR changed their attitude, if you will. Some things changed, which, and then of all things, the U.S. Post Office, because it was federal, or technically, the U.S. Post Office is not a federal office. However, it is a quasi-federal institution. Mm-hmm. And because of those laws that came in effect in the late 50s and early 60s, of course, a lot of black folks worked at the post office. A lot of black folks worked at General Motors. And so you had now, but there was no place to go except west. So you had the development of places like Jefferson Township, which came into being as a black community because now black folks could afford middle-class housing. So Jefferson Township came into being. But Jefferson Township is sort of southwest. So again, you're moving closer to Miamisburg and Springboro, and the bordering was the land that became the, for Miamisburg and Springboro and those places, the border between that and southwest Dayton became a dumping ground because traditionally they needed a place. You know, traditionally you go to the edge of your town, that's where you dump things,
yeah.
At the edge of your town. Well, the edge of their town was the beginning of our town, so to speak. And that's why you have things like the landfill and those kinds of things where you have them, because that's where those things were put, because it was at the edge of where the white folks wanted to be. It just so happened that the edge of where white folks wanted to be was also at more or less it stunted the expansion of the black community. So now you can't move east. Traditionally, you don't go past the river. That's what the river's for. It's a dividing, both economically and psychologically, it's a dividing line. You can't go north because there was nothing north unless you had the resources to build. There's nothing to go to. Eventually there was, because the white folks that didn't want to move further south decided that they would jump over the west side and go northwest and north. And that's where you have Englewood, Clayton, and those areas. So it has been a... There's an organization in Dayton called the Realtist who can give you a very, mm-hmm. Are you familiar with them?
I had heard from Dr. Magruder,
okay.
That realtor was a trademark term, and if you were black,
you could not be one.
You could not be one.
Exactly. So the black realtors had to create the Realtist, and they have a very thorough history of real estate in Dayton. So I would suggest that you speak to them. Okay. For the statistics of who lives where, and some real in-depth data, I would suggest you talk to Miami Valley for Housing. John Zimmerman would be, you know, however for this, the president may want to, Jim McCarthy may want to take time to speak with you, given what you're doing and how significant it may be. So I would suggest you definitely want raw data.
I do.
And Miami Valley Fair Housing can provide that for you. The Realtist can give you the more human aspect of, and can put in context the timeline, redlining, and then those kinds of things when it was very prevalent, when it was assumed, it was understood that if I say, yeah, I want to buy a house, okay, well then we know we limit our search to this area. And how dare you decide that you wanted to go elsewhere. Now, of course, in the late 60s, this became a challenge, a mantra. If I can afford it, I'm going to move where I want to. But of course, society was going through that evolutionary process. We were growing as a people, as a nation, and we were doing the things we had to do. But the reality is that the truth is, it's not so much, let me say it this way. People who are working every day, putting their kids through school, doing whatever it is people do when they can make a decent living. Very few of us are racist. Very few. People who stand to gain economically or monetarily and who have the power to construct institutionalized prejudice. Those are the folks that promoted this whole process. I can live any place I want to in Montgomery County. I work every day. I'm gonna be a good neighbor. I'm gonna cut my grass. I'm gonna take care of my house. It's not a problem. And I dare anybody to say anything different. However, am I comfortable? And see, the dilemma becomes, why do I want to move someplace where I cannot interact with my neighbors? That doesn't make sense to me. Well, I want to move someplace where I cannot interact with my neighbors because it's better. It's more, it matches my income, okay, and my own needs better. Why would I live in a house that's 60 years old or 50 years old when I can live in one that's 10 years old and I can afford to live in one that's 10 years old and have the amenities that come with same, right? I just have to drive a little further to visit, interact with family, and do those things because family doesn't live where I live. Okay, so that's always a consequence. But at the same time, the truth is this. For white folks who increase their own income and economic capacity, they also have that same dilemma. They often move away from where they grew up because it's better to live there. And so they have that same drama. Now they have to travel and so forth and so on. So the reality to me is, while Dayton has changed a lot for those of us in the middle income or upper middle income, it hasn't changed at all for the lower income. For the lower income, East is white, West is black, period. Now, here's a surprising thing. The map you look at obviously has to deal with populations and cannot deal with individuals. However, what I would suggest you do is drive the East and West sides, right? And you will see scattered throughout the East Side, black faces, interacting with no drama. And if you travel the West Side, you will see white faces, interacting, no drama, right? Left to our own devices, we are simply people. However, when I am a landowner, and I know I can charge higher rents in the black areas, then it behooves me to limit their ability to buy homes, because I need them to rent from me. And so I put things in place when I am the, and this is not throwing any stones, I'm giving you examples of what it takes. You got to be friends with the prosecutor because that's who decides what laws get or what crimes get prosecuted. And so even if someone says this is redlining, unless you can get the prosecutor to accept that this is redlining, it's not going to go anywhere. Unless in time it became, we had access to the federal level and the state level. So it's redlining and I can tell the governor. It's redlining and I can tell the federal government. But in the days when it was redlining and I can tell the prosecutor, then it was a waste of your time, right? And the wealth, those folks that can invest. If you want to, if you go to the Patterson family, the Kettering family, the Bierman family, and you say, look, I want to invest. And they say, well, yeah, there's property there that you can invest in. Well, you have that option. Because A, even if you're short, you go to the bank. And the bank says, well, that's a doggone good idea you got there. Sure, we'll help you finance that, right? But that's because you're white, right? And so therefore, those folks that wanted to deal with real estate, what better place to deal with real estate when you can control the variables more than you can in other places? And in the black community, you could control the variables. If I don't want to repair that, you can't make me. And if I want to charge this much rent, you can't stop me, right? So it became, and if I want to enact laws that make it very, very restrictive for you to move, like the whole concept of a lease that adheres me, laws of adhesion. I, the landlord, can put you out, but you, the tenant, cannot leave because you owe me the remainder of the lease. So whereas I can evict you, you can't decide until that lease is up to leave. And because the economy is what it is, when you get laid off and when your hours get cut, then I can say, okay, instead of paying me $150, you can pay me $135, but that 15 is going on the end. And human nature being what it is, I need that $15 elsewhere. And so we generally don't get back to that 150, it stays at the 135, but I'm racking up $15 every month that is added to my lease, plus penalties, plus other things. So I can't get out of this lease. I'm stuck now. If I leave this lease, then no one else is gonna rent to me because you guys are on a secret handshake. So if you're gonna evict me, he's not gonna rent to me. They will, eventually you guys will meet, country club, you'll smoke a cigar, you'll talk, you'll rent to me, but now instead of 150, I gotta pay 190 to get the less, to get the place that nobody else wanted, right? Because that's the only place I can get now. So that's where it became a process of that's where the origin of the perception that black folks live in ghettos. Okay, that was the beginning of this process, because you have property that's not been taken care of, you have property that won't be repaired, you have property that da 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 da. Plus, you know, I mean, the reality is that whereas in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, my kinfolk talk about being poor, but they talk about sweeping a dirt floor, because when you sweep all the loose dirt off of it, you have a nice packed surface that acts as a floor. Mm-hmm. It's a dirt floor, but it's still a floor, right? Mm-hmm. That's because you had pride in where you lived. Everybody was doing the best they could do, and everybody had the same frame of mind. However, as you become more urban in your relationships and your environment becomes more urban and brings into it all the urban problems, then you don't have that level of self-esteem, you don't have that level of self-awareness, and so therefore you are no longer that that motivated and that self-disciplined, right? So you become less than you were. And so now you see folks starting to internalize the ghetto aspect. And so now when the word is bandied about, you hear it and visually you see it, right? And whereas you're not educated enough to know that the word is a European word, a Jewish word in origin, you equate it to what you see, you know? And if you were, you said you're a history major, right? Okay, then you know the same drama is why you had ghettos in Europe. It's the same reason why you have ghettos here, because of exclusion and because of oppressive policies and practices. Same thing. So the word means the same thing, except in the United States, the connotation is that if it's a ghetto, it is black. If it is a ghetto, it is urban. And if it's a ghetto, if it's black and it's a ghetto, then it's you know, those three things are interreactive, black, ghetto, urban. Whereas you having studied, having been schooled, you know, the origin of the word, the origin of the whole process. And you know, it can be repeated, it can be implemented anywhere. All you have to do is control the conditions. If you can't work, and I limit your access to education and resources, then all of a sudden, ta-da. And if I own every place you can live, then yes, it's gonna be a ghetto. And as I get wiser and more greedy, then I will learn how to stack you on top of each other, and I'll make Cabrini Greens and those kinds of places, because there were studies done that proved that if you let a person spread out, one, it takes more land, but two, they interact better. But when you start to stack people up, they deal with rats in a maze. And they realize that when you do a maze as big as this table, but it's horizontal, and you let them rats run around, they maintain their sense of community a lot longer. When you start to stack them up, then they become a lot more aggressive, a lot less community oriented, rats in a maze, right? And so so one would say, well, no, Alfred, that's not true. We apartment buildings were built high because of the cost of land. Okay. Everything that's done always has a totally benign alternative rationale. I didn't hire you because you're black. I hired you because you're not qualified. Yeah, but I got a BA degree just like the guy you hired. Well, yeah, but see, I needed someone who did some social awareness volunteering in college, and you didn't. Yeah, because they don't have a 4-H club where I live. You know, there was not, that opportunity didn't exist, but I still got the grades, right? I still have the access to. Well, you know, and see, you can always come with a reason that says, well, yeah, but I don't want to. And when you own it, that reason is just all you need. So while there can be very legitimate sounding reasons for doing everything that's been done, the reality is racism is economically feasible for those that are already in economic power. So you promote racism because it keeps the money flowing. What was the point of slavery? Because it was free labor. So, you know, plus it has some psychological benefits for those that were the enslavers, but not that notwithstanding, it was about money, and it's always about money, right? So if I can create an environment that makes you pay me more and I have to spend less, then that's the environment I want, right? And then I can say it's just, you know, in my mind, I can say it's just business or whatever I want to say, but the reality is I'm no more qualified to dominate you than you are to dominate me. It's just I have the benefit of having a historical foundation that allows me that opportunity to dominate, right? You being born, if you were 59, I was 59, and we were born at the same time, all things being equal, it would just be a race, right? But you being born, me being born in the status in the United States, then obviously it's already assumed that you're gonna have some privileges that I don't. It is what it is, right? The housing environment is simply an extension of, you know, it's America. It is what it is. However, it becomes doable because I'm so busy making a living that I don't have time to sit back and ponder these kinds of things, right? And it's not so easy to train those that are coming about these things because they're not as obvious, they're not as in your face. See, when you have all of the things that, I know you want to stick to real estate, and so this doesn't need to become an overall conversation about racism, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to real estate, it's subtle. It's very subtle. And it is almost by mutual agreement. Because generally, I don't want to live where you don't want me to live. I can live in totally comfortable places and not have to put up with you any more than you have to put up with me, if that's the frame of mind either of us has. I live in a community that's mixed. But I'm not the old school borrow a cup of sugar type neighbor, so I don't interact with my neighbors as much, that much, right. And they don't interact with me. But we're all quite neighborly, and it's a very mixed neighborhood, right? And we're all making about the same amount of money, and da-da-da-da-da. And so we have more in common than we have that separates us. So we get along just fine, right? But if you thought you were exclusive, if you thought that you were more deserving, then you would identify that self evaluation by not wanting those that you could say were less around you. And that might be blacks, it might be gays, it might be Jews, it might be anybody that's not, that doesn't boost your own concept of who you are and why you should be king. And when you have the resources, then you do the same thing in real estate. Your real estate reflects your resources, so to speak. So when you can exclude folks and shut them out, that's what you do, as long as there's enough folks like you who want to buy. Hmm. Now when the well runs dry and there's not enough people like you to sell to, then all of a sudden, I'm okay. Hmm. Right? Because you want to make the money. So it is what it is. And I don't think that the reality is, I think that the map that you looked at reflects the truth, but the truth is complicated. And for the most part, black folks that want to live on the east side, they do just that. White folks that want to live on the west side, they do just that, right? But there are as many and as nice of places to live on either side where folks can do what they want to do. And because historically this separation was systematic, it just kind of has gotten comfortable that way now. You know, if I wanted to move on the east side, nobody would care. Not really, right? Now you do have, I just bought a house in November. I did run into some real estate agents in my search. I already knew who I was going to use, but sometimes you see a property and the agent's name is there, and so you contact that agent. I was exposed to some conversations where the person, and it was funny because the person on the other end of the phone could tell from my diction, from the way I articulate, that chances are he's black. And it was sometimes humorous to listen to them try to stay within the legal parameters that they have to stay into and still determine my interest in this property and whether or not, A, well, then it becomes a matter of, are you really qualified, you know? And that was rare. That was not my common experience. I did experience it, but it was certainly an isolated situation. I talked to several agents in finding a house, and it was a very small percentage that became uncomfortable with the process, that I wanted to see a property that was not in what they considered to be the traditional black area, right? So it's now, I think that, however, I don't think any real estate firm or large broker would be caught dead with an agent within themselves working to isolate or limit anybody's ability to move anywhere, because it costs too much to get caught, you know? But the agent who's only making commission, who's only making selling one or two houses a month or one or two houses every 3 months, yeah, they still have the same ingrown limitations and prejudices that they've always had, okay? So these things come out, whether they sell on real estate or shoes, it doesn't make any difference. The person is who they are. And if this is their bent, then this is the way they're gonna react. So I think that any problems now would be, now I tell you what the bigger problem is. It's not in buying a house, it's in renting. So when you talk to Miami Valley for housing, you might want to focus on the disparities in the rental market, not necessarily the buyer. The buying markets, they may have some information I don't have access to, and so I may be speaking out of school, but in my estimation, in my experience, it's the rental market that is the most, that still exhibits the same institutionalized separation that is traditional. Hmm. It's the rental market. Yes, not the buying market, because the buying market is too much controlled by federal stuff. You know, you have all kinds of things you have to do when you buy a house, and the government is involved in every one of them. From the time you take the initial loan application, you have to state, if you don't want to say what race and nationality you are, what race and ethnicity you are, the loan officer is supposed to make a best guess, because that box has to be checked on that application, period, right? So the federal government's involved a lot, but when it comes to rental, not so much. And that's where you're going to see, and people who own property still believe that it's their right to do what they want to do with their property, period. So that's where you see the biggest disparity, is in rental, is in the rental market. Yeah, not so much in the buying market. Not saying it doesn't exist in the buying market, but I think it's more prevalent in the rental market. And that's where it is.
So when you talk about disparities in the rental market, Is there more steering and things like this?
Yeah, just charge me more rent because I'm black.
Yeah.
Rent goes up because I'm black. This, you know, you have apartments. See, apartment complexes are managed by individuals. And so if the individual's difficult, then that's their own sentiments are going to be expressed in who they approve, who they, what applications they and this, and you run into it because you can email the application in, no problem. You talk to them on the phone, mm-hmm. Hey, here's the email address, you email the application in. I talk to them on the phone, it has to be a personal interview. Well, we need you to stop in so you can do this. We need you to stop in for this reason, stop in for that reason. They want to be sure and they want to feel comfortable that, yeah, I was right. Right, so, and then it becomes a situation where, well, he's a pretty clean cut black guy. He's not necessarily threatening because people have these perceptions. But instead of the 650, got to be 7.25. Now, the problem becomes when the places who advertise their rent in the paper. So I know it's 675, right? And all of a sudden, though, that unit's not available. But we do have another unit that we just finished. That one's going to be $75 more. Okay? So, you know, there's always a way to accomplish what you want to accomplish. And we already got one black family over there in that building, so let's put you in that building. You know, it's just, and that generally comes from who's managing the complex. So it boils down to just one individual who has the power to play these kinds of games. Big deal. But when it comes to single family dwellings that are being rented, now it's about the property owner. If the property owner says, you know what, I'd be more comfortable renting to a white family. Okay, you're never going to, because the truth is, I'd probably be more comfortable renting from a black family, if that be the case. Mm-hmm. But A, I need what I need. And if you're renting it, then I should have access to it. Unless there is something legitimate about me that says, hey, I've been evicted 3 times in the past 5 years, then yeah, I appreciate the fact that you don't want to rent to me. Why would you complicate your life by renting to somebody who obviously has issues paying their rent, right? So we're only talking about, if we apples and apples, then we're talking about qualified people. And you only, in the rental market, you run into the owner has the, or the rental agent has the power, if you will, to flex their muscle that way, if that's what they choose to do. So I think when you talk to Miami Valley for Housing, you'll find that there's, the bigger issue is rental housing as opposed to buying. Buying is too easy. Discrimination in buying a home is pretty easy to identify. And the big banks don't want, they do not want other lawsuits. They don't want, they don't need this. Whereas rental, you're renting from a guy who has 4 or 5 properties and he can be as big a-hole as he wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, no one's really watching him that closely and no one really cares. But for Dayton, it's gonna become more of an issue because we're having problems. We won't rehabilitate the available housing. So we invite investors from other places to come and buy blocks of housing. And so you're creating a monopoly from folks who don't have any real investment in this area. Excuse me just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, sweetie.
You busy?
I am. Can I call you back?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you still at work or you home?
I'm at work.
Okay. I'll call you back. You know, and but I think there's a problem in Dayton, but I don't think it's. I think there's a problem in Dayton, but I think there's also a solution in Dayton. And I think that the solution is the fact that, you know, if you throw a thing out and you don't want it anymore, that means it doesn't have value to you. It doesn't mean it doesn't have value. So the properties that are vacant, that have gone through foreclosure, as they are called vampire properties, the bank has basically still is on the lien or on title or has a lien on the title but won't accept the responsibility for the property because the owner is still in title, so, but the property taxes aren't getting paid, the properties are not being maintained. Well, these are opportunities to me. These are opportunities. Now, the problem becomes the same bank that has created qualifications that don't make sense in order to get a loan is the same bank you have to deal with if you want to rehab or acquire one of these properties. So therefore, in an economy where you used to make $22 an hour working at GM, and now you're making $11 an hour, $12 an hour working wherever it is you're working, Of course, during that transitional process, you run into some financial problems. Of course, you have some delinquent debt. Of course, you have anything that anyone would have when their money is halved. And so, but the bank's position is still the bank's position. You have to qualify at this level. In fact, now you have to qualify even higher because we did this little game with housing and mortgages, and we kind of things got out of control. And so now we've tightened down, you know, the requirements. Well, see, that's all a game. Nothing happens without someone planning it. This is not a coincidental environment. Nothing happens in this country. The only thing that's coincidental is whether or not you will get on the first elevator or the second elevator. And that's not a coincidence because you'll get on the one whose doors open first, right? So there are really no coincidences. So everything that happens is because someone with the resources and the aptitude and the desire planned it that way. So we had a banking crisis and a housing crisis because they were planned. Somebody made a ton of money. And now that allows those same powers to be to decide that now that folks want to buy houses again, only certain folks will buy houses. And this is where the truth about racism in the housing industry and the housing market is manifest. It's not so much in where we live, it's where we're allowed to buy. Because if you create, you know, and we don't want to get into, because I really don't want to get into, the whole issue of subtle and institutional and covert racism. But the reality is if you create an environment that says I can't buy or can't qualify to buy a mortgage, and it's true, if this is what it takes to qualify and I don't meet those qualifications, then surely I can't buy a house. But why don't I meet those qualifications? Well, because a whole bunch of other things have happened that make me, and then if you say, well, you know what? You wear a size 9 shoe, I wear a size 10. So I'm going to make the rule that you have to be larger than a size 9 to live here. Then you can't live there. And it's not because you're white, dog, not in this because you don't have a size 10 shoe. So you take a look at what exists and then you build guidelines around it, you know, and the guidelines happen to be exclusionary, but they're really, really safe, reasonable guidelines. And on the surface, it would seem as they are until you start to, if I'm a bank, and I make money through mortgages. The only thing I care about is whether or not you make your mortgage payment, right? But yet I'm going to create an environment that says, wait a minute, not only do you have to make your mortgage payments, you have to make every other payment. And you have to have done it for 2 years. Even in an environment where you can't compete and where everyone has had problems, I'm going to hold you to a higher standard, okay? Well, it just means I can't buy. But if I'm a bank and I want to make mortgages, all I'm really concerned about is whether or not you paid your rent where you lived. I don't care if you paid your credit cards, because I don't have a credit card with you. Now, a banker would say, that's not true, Alfred. I want to have a credit card with you, so it's important to me whether or not you pay your credit cards. But the reality is, the only reason I didn't pay my credit cards is because I couldn't. And if you put those same circumstances on anyone, they're going to respond the same way. Man, there is no one who says, children, we're not going to eat this week because daddy's going to pay the credit card bill. Nobody says that. Nobody says that. But if you have traditionally earned more money and been given access to more credit at cheaper rates, then you have some savings. And your car payment for the same car is $400. Mine's $475, $495, whatever the case may be. I live in 45406, so my car insurance is higher. You have as many wrecks in your neighborhood, but because you live in a predominantly white zip code, your insurance is cheaper. See, it's these types of things. And you say, well, the insurance company, what does that have to do with how much you charge me for insurance? And of course, they have someone who they hire that makes it all make sense through numbers and math. But the truth is, because I can charge you more for a product because you don't have as many options. If I'm going to allow you to have access to it, you have to take it because you can't say no and go someplace else. So you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And that's where the concept of this nation a society that has promoted and benefited from racism continues to do so. And of course that spills over in the housing market too. But it's really about the rental property, it's about the fact that lending institutions will not allow individuals to take advantage of the vacant and distressed properties that are still have value and can be rehabbed. That's the real crime here. See, when you have someone who wants to spend their resources and do a thing, then that's what you should promote. Why would you have look at Detroit. Wouldn't Detroit be stupid to say, well, you know what, we really want people to fix up these abandoned properties, but you got to have a 700 credit score to do it. That doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't make any sense. The property is deteriorating and going to waste. The loan that the property taxes are not being paid. So would it make sense to take a limited risk and put you in that property at an affordable payment and help you fix it up so that the property taxes start getting paid and then the whole system starts to support itself? But if you have a different agenda, if you have an agenda that says, I've got a 20-year plan, and the beginning of my plan is that I have to, A, establish myself as the real estate powerhouse in this area. I want to own everything. When new developments come, I want to be the developer. When new houses are built, I want to be the builder. And when old houses are rehabbed, I want to be the agent that does it. Well, then this is how you act. So anytime that there's a crisis like this, it's because when the dust clears, someone stands to gain financially. And if that someone has gained so much, they will create crisis in order to gain even more. And that's what is happening in the housing market right now. So that's the real, and you know, that's the real dilemma. And as a developer, we need to pay attention to developers that use minority contractors because they only use minority contractors in name. There are no minorities working on the contract. But there's a minority at the head who signed the paper. And therefore, the federal government doesn't require that I hire minorities to do the hammer and nail work, only that it be a minority contractor. And see, it's these types of things that are built into the system that allow it to be manipulated as such. And the public said, well, no, HUD has minority contractors, so we know that minorities are working on these deals. No, they're not. HUD requires that the contractor signing the paperwork be minority. It does not require that, very few HUD contracts require that the actual hammer hitting the nail be a minority. So there's always ways to still meet the letter of the law and never the intent. I hope that helped you, my man. You got any final questions for me?
Well, wow, yeah, it was very helpful. Thank you very much. I did have some questions about the federal government's implication in all of this. And so things about urban renewal and things like this, and suburbanization as well. I'm reading Ken Jackson's Crabgrass Frontier right now, and he was the one who came across the redlining maps from the 20s and sort of publicized that there was this evidence that was going on. But so I'm wondering about suburbanization and urban renewal and how those things, and then like in public housing versus the suburbs, and how that happened in Dayton. And then the other thing was how the crisis has influenced this stuff, but we talked about that a little bit. And then the gentrification as well, and whether or not this is a...
very involved, complicated thing.
Man. All of those are, yeah.
Especially the gentrification, especially the urban renewal,
the
suburban process. Because the truth is,
Suburbia
looks good. And we are all old enough to see the function of suburbia is to create a perception. I don't have a mall. So if I make enough money to spend, I can't turn my dollar off in my own neighborhood. I have to go to your neighborhood to spend money. I have to go to your neighborhood to watch a movie. Right? In Montgomery County, there are no movie theaters, no skating rinks, no bowling alleys in the black community. Now, do I bowl? Yeah. Do I skate? Yeah. Do I watch movies? Yeah. So, if I want to do these things, then I have to go to your community to do them, which means I have to take dollars out of my community and bring them and deliver them to your community. Now, the process of training citizens says that, see, this is all built into the whole part of our fabric that is still very racist and is being experimented even more so, because Dayton is a city that has, I've met Chief Beal, I've met Sheriff Plummer, I've interacted with deputies and police officers. And rarely, I go to the county courthouse and interact with the deputies weekly. I go through the process of having them in my pockets, go through the scanner, and I interact with these guys all the time. And the same true, I go to Dayton, see the Dayton courthouse. We have a housing coordinator where we help people dealing with housing issues. And I meet those officers. Those officers don't detest me. They don't dislike me. They don't separate or isolate or feel any different about me than they do anybody else, right? Because we are in a community where there's a certain amount of opportunity for everybody. However, in a community where that's not true, then those same officers will become a lot more. See, the reason that they interact and see me the way they see me is because, look at me. A, it's obvious that I'm not weak. It's obvious that I'm not stupid. But it's also obvious that I'm not a threat. So whatever your fears are, they don't have to manifest when you look at me, right? But if there were a situation where I was very poor, very limited, and very angry, and had a certain mindset, then you would have to actually police me. And so the line between protect and serve and policing becomes a little bit different, a little bit different. And, you know, so these are subtle things, but they're very real things. So when you create an environment where, and then when you say things like, but obviously you understand institutionalized racism, you understand covert racism as well as I do, you're intelligent. But the fact is here we don't see as much of it. We see it on individual levels in certain aspects. But see, if you do something stupid, if you do a crime, I really don't consider you to be a victim of the system. You volunteered for whatever it is the system has for you, you volunteered. Now, what is a crime? There are some crimes that are crimes only because they tend to happen in your community. There are other crimes that are crimes because they are an affront to humanity, period. Period, okay. The crimes that are only crimes because they tend to happen in my community, that is the thing that we would have to address, right? But how can you address a thing like that when the perception, when you have an argument about powder cocaine or crack cocaine, and you think, that's that, come on. But when the real difference is 3 years in the penitentiary or 15, then it gives substance to why you have to have that conversation, right? But it's an awkward conversation, period, because we're talking about a crime that's a crime that's a crime. And then if you build into this crime, well, yeah, but you know, cocaine is snorted and people go to work the next day and this and that, but crack is smoked and people fall off the edge. Okay, well, that's true. It's true. So, however, when you balance that against the fact that we have a criminal justice, prosecutorial prison system that makes money, then you have to factor that in and you have to realize, well, do you care that I'm destroying my own community with crack? Or do you care that you want to fill up the jail because you make money from it? Okay, and since crack in its abundance was delivered to this community, not developed in this community, then you start to see a nefarious process that was in place here, right? And it's the same thing with everything that we do. So, but these are all things that, you know, if I don't smoke crack, then I don't care and I'm not affected, right? However, being 60 and getting to 60, there's a lot of things I did that I wouldn't do anymore. So there was a lot of opportunity for me to run afoul of the more pristine aspects of my personality, right? Okay, so a person can make mistakes. Why should my mistakes of the same magnitude cost me so much more than your mistakes? Okay, and that's the issue. And it's always that issue. So the housing crisis as it was, sure, was an extension of that type of thinking, right? I've paid more for my interest rates higher, I've paid more for it. I paid more for it than it was worth. We had a process of overappraising properties. But I took the loan, right? I knew when I went to refinance my mortgage that my house was a $70,000 house. You appraised it at 85 or 90, and I wanted the cash. So am I a victim or a volunteer? See, and that's the problem, you know? But I needed the cash in order to live, because I don't make a lot of money. Well, maybe you're living beyond your means. Maybe I am. I mean, nothing is as simple as just saying, well, stand here in this line because that's where you fit. It's never that simple because we're human beings, right? So the reality becomes, it becomes very difficult to say, well, you know, this is a result of your own doing. And if you are not, if you don't have the fortitude it takes and the discipline it takes and the common sense and the self-awareness it takes not to do things that are harmful to yourself, come on. Why am I responsible for you in that way? Well, naturally you're not, unless you've created a certain aspects that limit my options and make me more susceptible to a certain. So you can always figure out what the masses would do. You can never figure out what the individual would do. Mm-hmm. But you can always, mathematically, you can calculate what the masses would do. See, if I sit up right now in this room and yelled fire, you'd say, man, there's a fire here, man. But if it were 50 of us in here and I said fire, 25 of us are going to run for the door. And you can predict that mathematically, right? So it becomes a process. You already know what people are going to do, given the right stimulus. And it happens in everything that we do. So I already know that you're going to give me enough legitimate examples of why I have to make this rule. So I'll make the rule first, and then I'll wait on the examples, and then I'll justify why I did it in the first place. And I'll just switch the dates and say, well, you know, I did it because. Well, no, because was because you did it. It is what it is. So in that respect, you know, the banking industry created the banking crisis, not the housing crisis, rather, and the banking crisis for that matter. Because, you know, in order for you to, if you buy a stock at $10, the stock drops to $8, theory is that you lost money. But see, I didn't need the $10, right? I got a million times that. So the $10 was a tool. I wanted the stock to drop to $8 so I could buy more of it. And now when I inflate it back to $14, I've made more money. And that's how you know, when you have the resources, that's how you do a thing. I want the housing market to grow, but I want to own it. So the first thing I do is crush it. And then I provide the resources to rebuild it. And since they're my resources, guess who owns it? So it's that process, and that is the basic bottom line of the whole housing dilemma. So when I say that there are 3,000 vacant properties in Montgomery County that can be rehabbed and revitalized, mm-hmm. all I need is a little bit of money and a little bit of elbow room to make it happen, because there are certainly homeowners, potential homeowners who want those properties. Then you say things like, the editorial you, mm-hmm. say things like, well, but you know, the way we got here was because we made loans to unqualified people. No, the way we got here was because we made loans to people that went to work every day in an economy that was repressive, and then we took their jobs away. That's how we got here, because you let multi-billion dollar companies like General Motors file for bankruptcy and kill pension plans. Okay? I've worked 15 years saving money, and all of a sudden it's worth nothing because you wanted to reorganize your debt, and the government let you do that at my expense. But did we have that conversation before Congress? No. No. And that was the conversation to have. You know, you've defunded everything that gave me the ability to compete. And now you penalize me for not being able to sustain myself. So, you know, that is the housing drama that exists is an extension of a much bigger problem. Much bigger problem. Okay? And that's not a problem that anybody's going to be able to rush in there and fix up, because, A, we're human beings and we're Americans, and we got this John Wayne mentality that says, hey, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Well, okay, I'm an American, and I kind of feel that same way, too. However, I'm also an American that's been institutionally repressed, and so I understand how on my side of the kitchen, you got air conditioning on your side of the kitchen, right? On my side of the kitchen, I got the stove. So, you know, these are things, but A, throughout history, there's always been tales of people who overcome all kinds of things. So I'm not a victim, and I won't be victimized. That's real simple. And once you start to think like that, then all this stuff really has no bearing for you. I mean, I'm aware, and I'm cognizant, but it has no real, and that's part of the problem, see, because now I've disengaged, and whereas I'm lower middle class, intelligent, working every day, and if I've disengaged from the issue, then there's not going to be any intelligent dialogue about it, period. And so that's the thing, you know, and you do that simple, easy. You got three kids. You take the favorite child, and you make sure that they progress. But you give the other two just enough to make them aspire to emulate you and the oldest child. Therefore, they stop fighting. They stop complaining. See, they stop protesting. And so now you're able to do things because nobody's constantly checking you. Nobody's constantly pushing the envelope. So then you decide to say, okay, now we have a new phase coming in, and we want to see how we can get this one off. So you, in isolated ways, you do things to test the waters. We are going into a situation where there will be a martial law in our cities on a regular basis. We don't see it because it's subtle and it's slow. But we're going to be a very controlled society. And the way you get that control is you push the envelope. So if I kill you, I'm a policeman, if I kill you, and there's no reason why I should have killed you, didn't have to, but I want to see what's going to happen. If you come out in force and act and you protest this thing, then I know, okay, I see. All right, I see. But then if I hit you with overwhelming force, and I give you a little rope, but nothing really changes, but I give you a lot of lip service, and you think things are changing, but it's really not. I'm free to do it again and again and again because nothing effective ever happened with the first one. And that's the way, it's just like kids. You've got brothers, sisters, mm-hmm. younger than you. No, you can't have that before dinner, but that hand is still going towards that cookie while they're looking at you. They're pushing the envelope, they want to see. Now a mom comes over, okay, can't have a cookie today. But tomorrow when I ask, I'm gonna be closer to the cookie when I ask. You know, I'm gonna figure out a way to get that cookie. Regardless of what you think is right, I'm going to get it. And it's the same way that the system is. The system will test you. It'll do something to you, and if you don't respond in a totally unified, assertive, focused manner, then it has now established a new beachhead. Mm-hmm. And from that, it will establish another beachhead. See, there used to be in the 60s, you're not old enough, but in the 60s, college campuses is where society checked itself. Our students knew everything that was wrong, and it was challenged on the college campuses. Sit-ins, protests, they were all college campuses. So what happened? We introduced promiscuity and drugs. And now colleges are not the source of social debate. They're not, but they used to be, and it was easy to stop because young people want to change the world. All young people want to change the world. Until you get them high. Now young people come out of college worried about student loan debt, ruined credit, and whether or not she's pregnant and whether or not it's his. And now a C+ is good enough. Now why would you spend $75,000 to get a C+? Have a 2.7 GPA. And it costs you $75,000, $100,000 to get there. If you ain't getting better than a 3-point GPA, why'd you even go to school? Because I didn't want to work. I think I'm supposed to make $20 an hour. McDonald's is only paying $9. So I went to school and got student loans. And this is how stupid we are now, right? But we don't see because this is how we're being changed. See, it used to be you went to college to change the world. You obviously believe that because look at what you're doing. You want to see what happened. And why? Because you want to figure out a way to change it. You want to alert people to what's going on and give data, do what an educated person to do, what academia says do. Establish the problem, support it with true data, and then evolve a solution out of that. That's what college is about. That's what we do. We train people to see what's wrong and then fix it. Unless the college is what's wrong.
I'll tell you what, I mean, yeah, we've been talking a lot about this at Antioch, and Antioch's got quite a history with this sort of social engagement.
Okay, I didn't know that. I'll have to look into it.
Yeah, I'll send you an article if you like. It's
a
pretty good one that gives the history of it. But we've got a thinking group, a reading group on about sort of colleges in general.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the students are interested in sort of on the metal of what's going on with higher education.
How it's been manipulated. It's just another way to make money, man.
That's right.
Just a way to generate funds for those that can set it up. They don't give a crap about you learning. They don't give a crap about your vision for America. You're graduating people who are dumber than they were 10 years ago. You've got a small core of people who develop technology that's actually old technology that's being marketed as new technology.
Yeah.
Cell phone technology. I came out of service in 1975 and we had cell phone technology. We use it all the time. In fact, what we should be using now is satellite phones.
Yeah.
We shouldn't even be using cell phones anymore. Cell phones are just a way to track you easier, less expensively. Satellite phones, we used to make satellite phones out of walkie-talkies because the engineers knew how to do it. You know, and engineers now know how to do so many things that are not made public to the public because, we don't want you to know that stuff yet.
Yeah.
We still want to, now, you know, I can give you, why is it that I have to pay? I have an internet. It's just the internet. The true internet, the computers that are the internet, okay, they were built long ago, they have to be updated, but they don't cost the kind of cost that has to be maintained the way cell companies aren't, IPOs aren't paying them that kind of money. Why am I paying them that kind of money? To get access to this thing. And people say it's crazy because somebody will charge for air. You say, oh no, they can't, but yes, they will. I pay for water to drink, right? I pay for everything, soon I'll be paying for air. Right? And so, but it's just to make money because, you know, if I develop a thing that has 6 working parts, and I looked at it like, look at the old Ma Bell system. You picked up the phone worked. You dialed anywhere in the country, fine. Ma Bell owned it on. The only monopoly that I ever thought was worth being a monopoly. Now it's broken down, and now I pay for everything. Now I pay for everything separately. So you can charge me separately. You know, it's just in colleges is that manifestation. Now you go to school, and no one's interested in you becoming wise. It's only can you pass the test, period. No one cares that you became an evolved person. No, did you pass the test? That's it, right? Because we don't want you thinking. We don't want you evaluating the world in which you exist. We prefer that you not be aware. And so therefore, college no longer provides awareness training. It no longer provides critical thinking. It provides a curriculum. If you pass it, good. Pay us our money and go figure out a way to make a living. And so you have a lot of people who never evolved, they went into college at 18 or 19, they came out of college older, but still emotionally the same age they went into because there was nothing there except sex and drugs that affected them on a personal level. They didn't meet anybody. You know, you've met people in college. You obviously have had the background that says the first step towards the rest of my life is to educate myself. Right? And so here you are. But how many folks just don't want to go to work yet, man? And so they go to college.
Yeah.
It is what it is. But look, I've got to get
busy.
Yeah,
all right.
But man, I really appreciate you taking